Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to the second hour of Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And this hour, we open it up for the lines for a pro-life open forum. Any question that you have on the beginnings of life, concerns you may have about how human lives are treated at that stage, or maybe some clarity you need about what is the appropriate treatment of human life at its earliest stages or at its latest stages, which is increasingly a matter of debate all around the world. We see an increase in exercises such as euthanasia and assisted suicide, and more widespread, we see things like the neglect of the elderly and the failure to care for and respect our elders. And also in the midst of life, we often face choices that confront human dignity. The questions about any of those are welcome today. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Dr. George Delgado, the medical director of the Culture of Life Family Healthcare. He is a board-certified doctor in family medicine and in hospice and palliative medicine. He also completed the certificate program in healthcare ethics offered by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And the National Catholic Bioethics Center is where we here at Catholic Answers send people when they have complex questions about bioethics that we think needs the very best answers in the world. Dr. Delgado, thanks for being here with us.
You're welcome. It's great to be here again.
Lots of stuff in the news. It's a tough time to be Catholic, I suppose, is one way to say it. But it's not just the scandals outside the church. I note, and you mentioned to me just before we went on the air, some articles noting this as well, that Catholic, even very old, century-old efforts to assist people in the adoption of children, assist children who are alone in this world to find families, are going out of business. And can you tell me something about that?
Sure, yeah. So one of the jobs of we as Catholic faithful, of course, is to take care of the poor and take care of the widow, the orphaned. And this is back from the times of the apostles, of course. And so Catholic involvement in adoption services goes way back, like you said, and even far further back in history than even the formalized groups that have been offering adoption services as an alternative to abortion. Well, now, unfortunately, the LGBT organizations and their allies, particularly the ACLU and Lambda Legal, have been targeting Catholic adoption agencies and running them out of business. They've been successful in San Francisco, in Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., and in Philadelphia. And what they're doing is they're demanding that these Catholic adoption agencies place children in homes of same-sex couples. And, of course, we know that a child has the right to be raised in a household that is going to nurture and foster good development, and that good development takes place in the kind of family that God designed, which is a mother and a father. Of course, there are times when that's not possible, when a spouse dies and you have a single parent raising a child, or when both parents die, which is happens when there's an orphan left, and there you try to find the best person to raise them. But placing them purposely in a same-sex couple family is not the best thing for the child. It causes a lot of problems psychologically and spiritually, and we know that. However, these agenda-driven organizations are trying to shove this down the throat of Catholic adoption agencies and having laws passed so that these agencies have to choose to either conduct their business going against their faith bases or go out of business. And, of course, no Catholic agency is going to want to compromise its Catholic ideals and beliefs, and so they've been forced to go out of business.
So I thought that, excuse me, but I thought that we were told that if gay marriage became a fact, it really wouldn't have any effect on anybody else. It has nothing to do with my marriage. It was the, you know, but now we're seeing that, like, children waiting adoption are being affected by this.
Yes, it's one of those things where that the whole playbook for the homosexual agenda was to first create awareness and by having jokes and different comedy shows, then creating tolerance so they would be tolerated, then creating acceptance, and then creating a situation where it's forced upon us. And that's where we are now. It's being forced upon us, and these same-sex couples, it's not that they don't have a right to adopt children. They can still go to other adoption agencies, and they could even create their own to adopt children. But it's just that a faith-based organization should have the right to conduct its business in ways that are consistent with its beliefs, and that's what's being attacked. And it's just another attack on Christianity and on the natural moral law.
But having lost the big case at the United States Supreme Court about gay marriage, it does seem that the logic of the courts then is kind of set. There really is no defense anymore in American courts for Catholic outreach or another Christian outreach for the purposes of finding adoptive families for children. Can defend itself anymore, because then if we've decided that it's bigotry to claim that heterosexual marriage and gay marriage are different, then what's the legal basis to defend ourselves?
That's right. We've put ourselves in a very difficult legal position, and our society needs to really recognize this and climb out of it and start to address this and take a stand. And people of goodwill, people who are Christians and others who agree with the family values that we espouse really have to take a stand and start electing officials who will appoint judges who will finally get things back on track.
Dr. George Delgado is our guest. It's Pro-Life Open Forum this hour. 888-318-7884 is our number. 888-318-7884. It's time to head to calls, if that's all right with you, Dr. Delgado.
Sure.
Donna in Cincinnati, listening on AM 740 Sacred Heart Radio. You are up first with Dr. George Delgado. Your question, Donna.
Hi. Last I heard, there were 16 states that gave the parents the right to claim their baby if it had been miscarried. And I know that of three organizations that provide caskets. There's a Elizabeth Ministry, Central California Embrace, and Heaven's Gain. But I know Central California Embrace is just for California, and Heaven's Gain and Elizabeth Ministries are for all over the country. But are there more local laws that I'm not aware of, or more places in different states that are helping with the burial of these miscarried babies?
Yeah, I don't know about the different organizations that are helping with this, and I'm only aware of California law. California law, which probably is similar to laws across the country because states often kind of tend to follow a certain template, is that if the miscarriage occurs after 20 weeks, then a death certificate is issued. Just like if a post-born person had died. Prior to that, though, you can still have a burial, and usually those would be in Catholic cemeteries that would be catering to that, but there would be no death certificate. But it's still perfectly appropriate and laudable to have a burial for the remains of a miscarried baby. So the best place to look for that really is to contact Catholic cemeteries, because they usually have a section of the cemetery for the remains of those babies.
Okay, Donna?
Yes, like Ohio, we have the Parents Grieving Act, and that actually does give you a different kind of certificate when you lose a baby. And the Parents Grieving Act actually gives the right to families to lose a baby. That happened in 2008. We lost our son in 2006, and we were just very blessed that they didn't place him in medical waste and that they did allow us to bury him. And so I just wanted to know how many states were doing that, because we're just really blessed that we were allowed to bury
him. Yeah, you are very blessed, and that's very forward-thinking and really keeping with the dignity of the, observing the dignity of the remains of any human person who has died.
Donna, thank you so much for that, because it's an important reminder to us. Because I think miscarriage is one of those things that people are have a very hard time, doctor, talking about, thinking about, and understanding what's the right or wrong thing to do.
Yes, I think so, and it's also difficult for those friends of those people knowing what the right thing to say is. It can become quite an awkward situation that really requires a lot of charity.
I wonder if there's a book out there about that, about what to do, you know, like about, are you familiar with anyone who's written about it?
No, I'm not. I'm sure there are plenty of books written about it. Certainly in the, I am familiar with the perinatal hospice movement
that
I've been involved with. And so I would maybe do a search on that, and I'm sure you could find some good books.
Dr. George Delgado, our guest this hour, it's a pro-life open forum. If you have questions about human life, human dignity, and the proper treatment of life in all of its stages, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. And is probably apropos of our topic this hour, I want to remind you that we have a kind of a deal on two really fine resources having to do with contraception. I want to say this book that that our publisher here put together, Todd Agliolaro, called Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humana Vitae, is one of the best books you're ever going to read on the Catholic understanding of human sexuality and particularly of contraception. Well, the deal is you get it for free when you buy Trent Horn's DVD, The Case Against Contraception. You just go to shop.catholic.com, see the special combo offer page there, and you can get them both for the price of one. And both are excellent. You will not be disappointed. I mean, I'm sure that there are many, many books out there on Catholic teaching on sexuality, and particularly on Humana Vitae. You're not going to find a better one than Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humana Vitae. Get it for free when you buy Trent's DVD, The Case Against Contraception, right now at shop.catholic.com.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice is our new radio show for young adults.
The Holy Spirit is about a new and exciting work in the young church of today. On Encounter, we bring young adults the life-changing testimonies of ordinary people that launch them into lives of extraordinary mission. Their testimonies bring faith and power into the lives of everyone who listens.
Encounter with Dan Demite and Patrick Rice. The spiritual awakening continues Saturday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour, Dr. George Delgado, eminently qualified to take your questions on life issues, and that's what this is, an hour of pro-life open forum. We go now to Anonymous, listening on Modern Day Radio. Anonymous, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, Dr. Delgado. I'm calling Anonymous, but I'm a mother of 10 children, and I'm just sitting out by my pool here, and I recognize your lovely voice. It's very distinctible. But I'd like to applaud you, Doctor, for being a wonderful Catholic doctor. You're a gynecologist and a GYN specialist. But I applaud you because there's very few and far between doctors like you. My question is, I have several children, of course, and several grandchildren, of which one of my children, one of my son-in-laws, is a physician here in my hometown, and he's debating, you know, doing a vasectomy. And I tell this doctor, my son-in-law, that, you know, the vascular system is always attached to the man's heart, and if you, you know, cut your vascular system, you know, it goes right to your heart. And I don't believe in that. And I want to know how to respond to all of my 7 sons and 3 daughters about birth control. And as being, actually, they're not practicing Catholics, but yet they send their children to Catholic schools. So.
Fair enough. How do we respond to our children on these matters?
Yeah, so that's, first of all, thank you for being open to life and for mothering 10 children. And don't, although they're not practicing Catholics now, don't give up on them for sure, because your prayers, your sacrifice, your fasting can really help them come back. And someday we pray that they will. Now, as far as how to talk to them, there are a couple of different things. You know, the first thing is you want to keep the relationship going without affirming what they're doing. And so that's a balance, because you want to affirm and love them without being accepting of what they're doing, if they're doing something that is sinful, like contraception, or if he goes forth with the vasectomy. Now, specifically, if they're asking you for advice, then that's a good position to be in. If they're not asking you for advice, then you have to be careful in your position as the mother or grandmother not to offer unsolicited advice, because sometimes the relative is not the one that they seek to accept advice from. So that's kind of a judgment call there. If you think there's an opportunity, of course, you take it, but you have to be very careful and diplomatic, again, without giving your approval to what they're doing. So if they do ask for advice, then, and they're not practicing Catholics, you can just say, do you want to have a conversation about it? And then you can ask them if they want to talk about what the church teaches. And if they're open to that, then you should be well-versed in what the church teaches and be well-versed in Humana Vitae, and even offer to give that to them and have it on hand. And tell them this is only a 16-page document. It's not that hard to read. It won't take you that long. Why don't you read it and see what you think? That's one thing. The other thing you could do is you could hand them Janet Smith's tape, Contraception, Why Not?, which can be very, very persuasive. Or you can get some of the great Catholic Answers materials that were just mentioned by Trent Horn and the other document supporting Humana Vitae. Those can be really good coming from someone else. So if otherwise, if they're willing to have a discussion with you, then just talk about why the church insists that contraception is intrinsically evil, about the marital embrace, and how there are two aspects of it that are inextricably linked, and that's the unitive and the procreative. And with contraception is an attempt to separate those two, and that what it really does is it destroys the whole meaning of the marital act, and you're going against God's design. If they don't want to talk about Catholic things, then you can just present them more of a natural law argument. Or if they've drifted away from the church and maybe gone more to a Protestant congregation, you can talk about the Bible and how the Bible has plenty of passages that support life and that can be used to oppose contraception and certainly a sterilization. And with the sterilization, you can talk about a very practical thing. You can say, you know, this is such a permanent thing. Why don't you give it some time and pray about it and read about it and at least hold off on doing that very permanent thing, because you might regret it later, and that it's you're mutilating your body for a reason that is not because you're ill. And the physician should understand that we don't do unnecessary procedures to damage the body when there's not a disease to be treated. And you can point out quite frankly that fertility is not a disease to be treated. Fertility is a gift that can be co-managed by us with God, but not a disease to be treated. So those are the tactics and the strategies I would take. But again, always being humble and never coming at it from don't lose your temper. And remember that we're here not to win debates, but we're here to win souls for Christ. And remember to be in it for the long haul and keep sustaining that relationship and keep the prayer and the fasting going.
Anonymous, if you'll hang on the line and Marie will get your digits, we'd like to send you a couple books. Inseparable, that one I mentioned before, it really is a beautiful book, and it might open some conversations up. 5 perspectives on sex, life, and love in defense of Humana Vitae. But also Trent Horn and Layla Miller's brand new book, Made This Way. It's actually so brand new, it's not even out yet. It'll be out in a couple weeks, and I'd like to send you that. The subtitle of it is How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues. If you'll hang on, Marie will get your numbers, and we'll send that off to you. We go now to there was actually a caller who called and hung up but asked the following question, if I may, Dr. Delgado. The caller asked, is it okay to cooperate with evil when you think it can bring about a greater good? For example, voting for a candidate who is pro-choice.
So the short answer is yes, it is possible. But you have to look at this very carefully, because the whole concept of cooperation with evil is very important. To cooperate with evil means to somehow facilitate evil. And there's different types of cooperation with evil that we can discuss. And the first is called formal cooperation. And formal cooperation is when you agree with what the person is doing or agree with the evil. So that would be voting for a pro-choice or pro-abortion candidate because of the fact that that person is pro-abortion. And so you're agreeing with that, and that's why you're voting for that person. That would always be morally unacceptable and would be a sin, objectively, to do that. So that formal cooperation with evil is never acceptable. The other is called material cooperation, and that is when you don't agree with the evil. For example, you don't agree, you are pro-life and you don't agree with a person's pro-abortion views, but you're voting for the candidate for another reason. And here it all depends on the circumstances surrounding it. So let's say if there were two candidates and both were pro-choice, pro-abortion, then you picked the one who is least evil, you voted for that candidate. That would be acceptable if there were no other alternatives. Or if there were, let's say, three candidates and one was pro-life but had realistically no chance of winning the election and had other things, maybe you did not agree with those, and the other two candidates were both pro-abortion, you would pick the one that was most pro-life of the two that were pro-abortion and vote for that one. That would be acceptable too. So you have to be very careful, because there's also the aspect of scandal involved with this, where if someone knows you're voting for a pro-abortion candidate, that might reflect poorly on you and give a bad example to someone else and lead them to later on maybe do things that were sinful because of your example. So you have to take all that into account, but there could be situations where you, yes, indeed, could vote for that candidate.
We'd love to give it just a simple answer in that, but it's not simple. I mean, the basics are simple. Like you can't ever want to forward evil. You can't cooperate in that sense. Like, oh, I'm going to vote for this candidate because they're pro-abortion and I'm pro-abortion. That's simply right. Evil. But there are so many gray areas beyond that.
There are. And the other pitfalls of that that I probably should mention just for completeness sake is that you also cannot look at all of the issues and weigh them as if they're equally important. So, for example, if there's a candidate who's pro-life, but let's say has views on immigration that aren't always in line with the church's teaching, or maybe is views on gun control that differ with yours, and maybe there's kind of social issues that don't exactly agree with you, you can't sort of weigh them all together and say, okay, on balance, this candidate is not as good as this pro-abortion candidate because this pro-abortion candidate has a better view on immigration or gun control or social issues and is more in line with the church's teaching of the preference for the poor. You can't do that because the life issues have a predominant role, and because life is such a great gift that without life we can't enjoy any of these other benefits that a candidate might offer, like better living situation or better help for the poor. So we really have to give priority to the life issues, and especially to the life issues, how they involve the vulnerable. And that's very important to keep in mind.
A caller called to us. We were asking ourselves, basically, if we could think of any resources having to do with miscarriage. And Elizabeth Petricelli, who's a fairly well-known Catholic woman, has a book called All That Is Seen and Unseen, A Journey Through a First Trimester Miscarriage. I can't recommend it. I don't know it. But I thought since we raised that topic, we'll share what a caller passed on to us. Let's go now to Terry in Houston, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Terry. Oh, no, I'm not going to Terry because my phone lines just went dead. So it may be that all the call, well, Dr. Delgado's still there, so the callers have dried up on us, but not Dr. Okay. Delgado. You're still here, Dr. Delgado, in case you thought you went somewhere. In this 50th anniversary of contraception, of the teaching against contraception that was consistent with the entire teaching of the church from Pope Paul VI, are you seeing in your life as a doctor more acceptance that the church's teaching might not be nonsense, that it might actually be valuable in people's lives?
I really am. I'm seeing a lot of young, faithful Catholic couples who are coming in, and they know about the church's teaching, and they fully agree with it, and they see that contraception is an evil and that will not help their marriages. And I'm also seeing younger people who are pre-marriage who also hold the same view. So I do see a lot of hope there.
I'm glad that we're having a little hope on that front. It's been a long kind of period of darkness and confusion in the church, and I hope that it is beginning to clear up. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more pro-life open forum with Dr. George Delgado. 888-31-TRUTH, the number, 888-318-7884.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. We asked five distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humanae Vitae from five perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic of contraception comes up among friends, family, and co-workers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Is the Church wrong on contraception? In a culture that worships the pursuit of sexual pleasure, the Catholic Church's teaching on contraception can seem archaic and unintelligible. Its critics say it's outdated, theologically unfounded, and even harmful. And even faithful Catholics can have difficulty explaining this moral teaching. Catholic Answers is out to change all of that. That's why we've just released Trent Horn's dynamic new DVD, The Case Against Contraception. Using scripture, papal and magisterial teachings, natural law, and new insights provided by social science and medicine, Trent puts forward a compelling case for Catholic teachings with his trademark charity and persuasive graciousness. Be prepared to give a defense. Order your copy of The Case Against Contraception today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. There are a lot of misconceptions about the Catholic faith. We clear them up on Call to Communion, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Pro-Life Open Forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Dr. George Delgado, our guest, and Christian in Gainesville, Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers app, is next. Christian, thanks for downloading the Catholic Answers app onto your phone. Your question for Dr. Delgado.
Hi. Wow, I can't believe I actually made it on the radio. I'm a little nervous. So my question for Dr. Delgado is that of end-of-life hospice issues. I was a bedside nurse for a few years, and I've had some firsthand experience with this where patients, even though are not actively expressing distress, but are experiencing something which you may think is distressful, and you give them some sedation medication towards the end of life. What is the church's perspective on that?
Well, you know, the church teaches that we should treat patients' symptoms, and we should give them very good palliative care. There's no doubt about that. But it has to be done ethically and appropriately. So there are abuse potentials certainly there. And the abuse potentials are many, including withdrawing fluids and nutrition inappropriately. And also there can be the abuse of using palliative sedation inappropriately as a way, kind of as a soft euthanasia, as a quiet, under-the-radar euthanasia. But what good palliative care would do, if a patient has physical symptoms, and I stress that because most good programs emphasize that palliative sedation should not be given to a patient who's having existential pain or suffering. And existential suffering is the anxiety and the distress and the despair one feels because of the impending death. But if there are physical symptoms like pain or shortness of breath or nausea, other things that are not controlled by the usual treatments, the usual medications, then there can be the use of palliative sedation. What palliative sedation would be to giving higher doses of opioids like morphine and benzodiazepines, Valium-type medications, to put the patient into relatively deep sleep so that the patient is no longer experiencing the physical suffering. Now, good palliative sedation, of course, will then, if the symptoms are well controlled for several hours or a day, will then start to back off on the medications to see if the patient can come back to consciousness. And so therefore, the patient can be conscious, and because we value being conscious, we're still with the symptoms under control. And at that point, if the patient can eat or drink again, can eat or drink again. Or if the patient were requiring intravenous fluids would be continued even as long as they were not causing suffering in and of themselves. So with those parameters, with good ethical use, then the church would definitely approve of palliative sedation, just like it would approve of any kind of treatment whose aim is to decrease suffering. And when there's no better treatment that can be offered, even if it's anticipated that there will be some risk of shortening the lifespan of that person. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, it does. Can I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
Go ahead, Kristen. Yeah.
So is it ever licit to, like, let's say, for example, you're going to withdraw a ventilator off of someone, and you know that they're going to, and there's, I mean, you can never know, but you have a strong indication that they will probably die within minutes, and you know that they may have some, you know, airway edema causing some stress. Is it some distress or something along those lines? Is it ethical to preemptively medicate or any situation at all where you are going to do something as part of the process that you think, like, can you preemptively medicate for something that you think will cause distress? Is that licit towards
yes.
the end of life?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's not only licit, but it should be done. And so with our protocols, when we take patients off ventilators. And the ventilator, for all of you who don't know what that is, it's a breathing machine that breathes for a patient. There are times when a patient no longer desires to be on the ventilator because it's causing too much burden, or the ventilator, the patient can't really choose because the patient's not communicative, but we see that the ventilator is causing more harm than good. Then we do what's often termed a compassionate extubation. We take the patient off the breathing machine, and we can very well anticipate that with taking the patient off the breathing machine, there's going to be a great sense of breathlessness immediately. And so we do and we should premedicate often with morphine, because morphine is a really good medication for decreasing the sensation of shortness of breath. And also we often will premedicate with a benzodiazepine, a Valium-type medicine, because of the anxiety involved with it. And that is the kind and compassionate thing to do. And then once we pull it off, then we see how the patient is doing. If the patient is having more breathlessness, we increase the doses. If the patient is doing well, then we might decrease on the dosage and see how the patient does. And I've been involved with these cases of compassionate extubations where it's gone very well and the patients have been very comfortable. One case in particular jumps out at me. It was an elderly woman who afterwards she started talking to her family and she said, "Hey, somebody bring me lunch." She was able to eat a little bit. She was able to visit with all of her family. And then finally, about 20 hours later, she did pass away from her lung disease. But she was able to have that time without being connected to a ventilator to have some wonderful quality time to say goodbye to all of her family members. And that was a great thing. And she did not suffer because we did pre-medicate her.
Thank you very much for that call, Christian. I sometimes notice in secular media, particularly I'm thinking of an article that was in the New York Times maybe a month ago. I mean, no, there was the Los Angeles Times maybe a month ago, where it was suggested that the Catholics are kind of a little bit hypocrites on this because, they won't go with euthanasia, but they are giving people these medicines that are, in fact, hastening their death.
Yeah, so there, you know, the medications may hasten death. So that's the key thing there. And the second key thing is intention. So with euthanasia, you're killing a patient directly because you don't want the patient to suffer. With palliative sedation and other good hospice and palliative medicine treatments, what we're doing is we're giving a treatment that might have two effects. And I say might because there are some patients, when you control their symptoms, they actually live longer. And so we've seen that many times. But in the case of, let's say, palliative sedation, you have one treatment, the palliative sedation, whose intention is, again, to alleviate symptoms. There's a foreseen second effect that is not wanted, that is not desired, and that's that it may shorten the patient's life. But there's no better treatment. And the two, the slightly shortening the life compared to alleviating symptoms that are very burdensome, they are about of equal magnitude. So in that case, we apply the principle of double effect, and we are able to morally choose that and go with that, as opposed to with euthanasia or with physician-assisted suicide, you cannot apply the principle of double effect because there's one action, and that action is either to directly kill the patient or the patient kill him or herself. And from that action then leads the supposed good action of alleviating symptoms. You're alleviating symptoms because you no longer have a patient who can suffer those symptoms. So you can see that it's not at all the same situation. So there's no hypocrisy there whatsoever.
We go now to Kathy in Colorado, listening on AM 1060. Kathy, your question for Dr. George Delgado. Kathy? Oh, excuse me. I apologize. It's Kelly. Kelly in Colorado. I apologize. Are you there, Kelly? It doesn't. Neither Kelly nor Kathy is there.
I'd like to address her question, which she gave to the screener, just because I think it's something that's worth addressing.
Okay. Let me try her one more time here, Doctor. Let me see if I can get her. Kelly in Colorado, listening on AM 1060. Do I have you with us? Apparently not. Okay. So the question that she asked the call screener, which we can see on our screens, is which is a greater evil, coat hanger abortions where mothers die or abortions?
So here I think this is somewhat a rhetorical question, of course, but that's why I wanted to address it. And the first thing is the whole premise of these, quote, coat hanger abortions. Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who was the founder of NARAL, and who was one of the first abortionists in this country who popularized abortion and who aborted tens of thousands of babies in his career, later had a conversion. And he gave the historical account of the propaganda campaign that was waged in order to make abortion legal in this country. And he said that this whole idea about there being thousands and thousands of illegal back-alley abortions, of coat-hanger abortions, he said that those numbers were purely fabricated and pulled out of thin air. And so it was a big lie, first of all, that there were these thousands and thousands of coat-hanger and other illegal abortions taking place and that women were being maimed and damaged by illegal abortions. That just – it happened to a small extent, but it really was not happening on any scale that people were led to believe. It was part of the big lie of the abortion propaganda.
Doctor, I'm going to interrupt you just quick while you're making your points, because I believe we do have Kelly on the line. I'm not exactly sure what happened.
Great.
But Kelly, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can. And we saw your question, and so I just read it to Dr. Delgado. You know what we'll do? I'll tell you what. Let's take it. Can you hang on for a quick second, Kelly? All right, we got to take a quick break, and then we'll reset, and you can address Dr. Delgado directly, because it is a conversation we'd very much like to have. That's all right with you, Dr. Delgado?
Sure.
Take a quick break. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Philip Rivers, NFL quarterback, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The devil will always do his best to tempt you into sin until you get to that place where you love sin. That's what he wants. He wants you down there with him. And not because he loves you, he hates you. When you do what the enemy tempts you to do, he does it out of pure hatred.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. It's a pro-life open forum. We had a little confusion with the calls, and I apologize for that, with Kelly in Colorado. Kelly, the question that I gave the doctor is, which is a greater evil, coat hanger abortions, where mothers die, or abortions? Does that sum up your question, and do you want to give it a little context? Kelly, what happened here? Kelly, go ahead, Kelly.
So I converted this last year to Catholicism, and admittedly, before I understood the Catholic faith, I was pro-choice, and something that just, like, I still have confusion on is, like, if the greater evil is allowing abortion to happen or allowing unsafe abortions to happen with, like coat hanger abortions, because it's just something that's so, like, bad, you know?
Okay. Doctor?
Okay. Yeah, so, Kelly, thanks. I'm glad we got you back. So what I was stating earlier was that we really have to put this in the proper context, and this whole idea of widespread illegal abortions and coat hanger abortions and women being maimed and damaged and hurt before abortion was legal, all that is really pure propaganda. And Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who's since deceased, who was the founder of NARAL, National Abortion Rights Action League, and who was one of the big forces in convincing Americans that abortion should be legal, he admitted that they all gathered together when they were planning their strategy. And although, of course, illegal abortions were taking place, I'll grant that, but they pulled this number of thousands of illegal abortions out of thin air. They totally fabricated it in order for the purpose of their propaganda. So I don't think that that's a good argument, first of all, to start off with. So I'll start with that premise. The second thing is, just from an ethical standpoint, we can never approve of evil in order to try to get something that we think is less harmful. So, in other words, we can't support legal abortion because, well, they're going to get abortions anyway because we're formally cooperating with evil. And abortion is an intrinsic evil, of course, because it's a killing of an innocent human being, not to mention the damage it does to the woman having the abortion, in which she is victimized by the abortion medical complex, and she's put at risk of preterm delivery, and she's put at risk of breast cancer, of depression, increased risk of suicide, all of these bad things that happen to mothers who have abortions. So for us to formally support abortion because we want to decrease the chance of a woman going out and having an illegal abortion, from an ethical standpoint, really doesn't make sense because we're formally cooperating with evil. What we should do instead, the better thing, is to work to make abortion illegal and work to increase our support for women who will have illegal abortions. And I would suggest that the women who, in the future when abortion is illegal, who have illegal abortions, should not be prosecuted. They instead should be treated like survivors of suicide attempts. We don't try to put those people in jail. No, we give them the help they need, the psychological help, the physical support, the social support. But we would aggressively go after the doctors and other people who are promoting or conducting illegal abortions. That, I think, would be the much more, more common sense and ethically appropriate approach to that situation.
Kelly,
how does that sound to you?
Sorry, yes?
How does that sound to you, Kelly?
Yeah, that really clarifies it. I just, because I'm so new, because I'm a convert, it neither really made sense to me, so that really clarified it.
Well, welcome to the church, Kelly. When were you received into the Catholic Church?
This last Easter.
God bless you, sister. Will you call again? We're happy to take your questions.
Sure.
All right. Very good. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I'm so sorry that we gave you the runaround there. That was entirely my doing. Sabrina in Española, New Mexico, listening to EWTN on XM satellite radio. You are up next. Sabrina, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can. Your question?
Hi there. My question is, I suffer with PCOS, and it causes me to not ovulate or not have a cycle. So my doctor's answer to fix this for preventative maintenance, if I ever want to have a child, is to take birth control. But I'm not comfortable with that because of my faith, and I'm curious if that's true, that I need to have it preventative, or if I should take it because I'm not using it as a contraceptive. I just want some clarification on it.
Okay, that's a great question. Do you mind if I ask you how old you are?
I'm 24.
24, okay, so you're young. Yeah, so I would think that, you know, putting you on a birth control pill would have one advantage of protecting the lining of the uterus from developing cancer. However, it would put you at significant other risks, including increasing your risk of breast cancer, especially if you've never had a term pregnancy. So we know that the birth control pill does that. It also would increase your risk of blood clotting disorders, including blood clots in the legs that could break off and go to the lungs, increase your risk of heart attack and stroke. So the much better way to accomplish the same thing would be to have you take natural progesterone once a month or even once every 3 months to balance the lining of the uterus so that you would no longer have that risk of cancer. That would accomplish everything that the birth control pill would without all of those risks and side effects. Furthermore, there are other treatments that would be even better. You could take a medication called metformin that's been shown in women with PCOS to induce them to ovulate. And then when you are thinking you probably want to have children, then there's a surgery you could have called an ovarian wedge resection. I would go to a surgeon who is skilled in that, not to any surgeon. And that is the closest thing we have to a cure for polycystic ovarian syndrome. If you want to learn more about those treatments, go to a website, naprotechnology.com, and you can read up there on treatments for PCOS. So unfortunately, the birth control pill is a hammer in the toolbox of gynecologists, and whenever there's a woman who has something going on and she doesn't want to get pregnant, they automatically put her on the birth control pill, and it's really a tragedy because it's not a good treatment and exposes you to a lot of risks, not to mention if you are having sexual intercourse, if there is a risk of an early chemical abortion caused by the birth control pill. So lots of bad things with it, and I don't recommend it for most things.
Okay, Sabrina?
Yes, that answered so many of my questions.
Well, that's what we're here for. That's why we like to have Dr. Delgado on. Thank you so much, Sabrina, for that call. I'm going to just move quickly to try to get as many as I can in. Dan in Kansas, listening on Divine Mercy Radio. You are up next. Your question, Dan.
Hello, Dr. Delgado. Thanks for taking my call. My dad died a couple months ago, and he was 90, and he lived a good life. So, you know, I hope I can do the same. But at the end of his life, he went into organ shutdown and became comatose. And the consensus was to put him on what's called comfort care, in which basically they just, you know, monitored how comfortable he seemed and gave him morphine as needed. And they didn't really expect him to last more than a day or two when he first became comatose, but it stretched on to, you know, I think it was about 7-8 days before he finally passed away. And 3 or 4 days into that, you know, it occurred to some of us family members that he wasn't getting any food or water. Now he's comatose, but no IV fluids, and we were, you know, kind of concerned. Are we torturing Dad to death? Are we, you know, is he dehydrated and he just needs a little water? We talked to the doctors about that, and they told us that that's just not standard part of comfort care. And these same doctors were with my dad through thick and thin, and were very good doctors, and, you know, made him live a lot longer than he should have.
All right. But, so, Dan, you'd like some clarification. Just I'm running up against the clock. So you'd like some clarification from Dr. Delgado on that entire situation.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Delgado?
Sure. So if truly he were only going to live for a day or two, then it would have been fine not to give fluids and nutrition because it would not have made a difference. So in those cases, we're not obligated. We're also not obligated if the fluid and nutrition is not going to be absorbed or assimilated, or if it's going to create a burden, which sometimes is the case. In your father's case, I think what happened was they guessed wrongly. They didn't expect him to last so long. So the best thing in retrospect, not knowing all the details of this case, of course, and not to cause any guilt, but probably the best thing would have been for the doctor to say, hey, you know, he's probably going to last longer. Let's go ahead and give him some IV fluids so that he dies of his disease and not of dehydration. That would have been the best thing. And to say that fluids are not part of comfort care is really not correct, because fluids can give comfort, and we can give fluids in order to make people more comfortable so they don't suffer from any of the symptoms of dehydration. And also because, like I said, we want the people to die of their illness, not to die of dehydration. So I think this is a case of them having guessed wrongly, and that's kind of unfortunate. But, of course, not your fault or your family's fault at all. You're following the medical advice of people you trusted.
Dan, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't know. That's kind of what we were afraid of. And as you say, I mean, doctors are human just like us. So I think they were doing the best they could. But just...
And the dying process is a complicated process. It's very particular to each person, Dr. Delgado. And we do have to accept that it's not always going to be perfectly handled.
You're right. It's not always going to be perfectly handled. And we do have to have the bias for life. And so we always have to be very careful when we do things that may shorten life and make sure we have a good reason to do it. And that's very important. That's why the dialogue between family and the doctors is so very important. And I think, you know, in the future with other people in your family, I'm sure that, Dan, you and your family will have a different perspective, and you'll maybe question doctors more if they go this course. And I think the good question to ask is, if you say, well, why isn't fluid part of comfort care? Why can't we have it? And they won't be able to give you a good answer. And then if they say, well, it's going to harm him more, and say, well, how do you know it's going to harm him? And then they might give an answer, and then you can say, well, why don't we try it at a low flow rate and see how he does? And if he does okay, then we continue. If he doesn't, then we could always stop it. And so I think that kind of give and take is always quite helpful in handling these kinds of situations, because doctors sometimes get in a certain locked in a certain lane of a treatment plan they always use on everybody. And sometimes they need to be reminded that we need to personalize and customize our care to each and every individual.
Dan, I hope that's satisfying and helpful to you. A complicated situation, but I will say that it strikes me that, doctor, that we often need help with these situations because advanced technology is so it brings up so many complex issues. I do think that people can contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center if they have questions about a standard of care or whether care is appropriate. Am I correct about that?
That's right. They can, and they have a great website just for general information. They also have a hotline to get a consultation, and you can go to ncbcenter.org, ncbcenter.org, National Catholic Bioethics Center. And it's also good just to... When you are selecting a physician, talk about these things when you're doing the evaluation process to see if that physician is right for you. If that physician knows about Catholic teaching, knows about good ethical approaches to care, because that's so important these days.
Thanks so much for that call, Dan. We really do appreciate it, and our condolences on the loss of your father, and our congratulations on you doing your very best to care for him. That means so much. And what can we do? We can do our best. That's all we can do. Dr. Delgado, thanks for another great and very informative hour.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And join us tomorrow for 2 hours of Open Forum. If you didn't get through today with Dr. Delgado, well, Open Forum means any question you've got on the Catholic Church, on Catholic faith, on Catholic people, Catholic beliefs, they're all welcome. We'll be here and see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.